Gentlemen, it's time to get in touch with your guy side at POP Fishing and Marine. Explore the marine part of POP. Just past the cash register, through the big doorway, a huge warehouse, open to everyone, filled with boating parts and supplies. A genuine metrosexual free zone. Real work gloves, heavy duty boots, foul weather jackets. No pastel colors here, only marine blue, bright safety orange, zinc and stainless steel. Gear for sailboats and powerboats, pumps, engine parts, trailer parts, coolers tough enough to hold ice for 12 days, anchors, meat smokers. It's time to get your man up and your gear on. Our experts will help you find exactly what you need, and if we don't have it, we'll bring it in for you. Let your guy side out to play, guys. Gear, glory, we got it. POP Fishing and Marine on Pier 38 next to Nico's.
You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Okay, welcome back. You know, one of the things that I was talking about earlier was our getting together with Josh Jamella. Now, normally, Josh Jamella from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council and I bang our heads together early part of the week. Well, what's going to be on Go Fish for the next couple of weeks? He's the one that has been reaching out and just lining up this incredible pool of expert and talent and people that we're able to spread the information for. And it dawned on me that we hadn't talked to Josh wearing his own hat for a while, and that is a fishery analyst. And it's really, really interesting because they do all of this really great work sometimes, and sometimes I feel like, gee, this is really great, but who gets it? Well, today you guys are going to, and gals are going to get a chance to get in it, because I think it's sort of appropriate. Josh, first of all, thanks for coming in. Nice to see you again.
All right, good to be back.
And secondly, we're getting towards the time of the year where everybody starts working about holidays and this and that, and one of the things that really vacillates around holidays is fish, especially here in Hawaii, right? And isn't it interesting how much has been in the news lately of salmonella, of hepatitis, of raw this and raw that? And here we are, the connoisseurs of raw fish, and you guys are the horn of plenty of information about all this stuff. Are people getting more inquisitive about what's safe and what's not?
I think we've been getting more and more inquiries into what is fresh, what is local, You know, people are getting more and more interested in what they're eating.
I tell you one thing that I've pleasantly noticed, whether you're at a big box or a little mom and pop, people are actually looking at the labels now. And that sort of tells a lot, right?
Right, especially when you have carbon treated tuna and all these other frozen fish.
I must tell you, though, looking for fresh. On the tuna that you're talking about, the gas tuna, they don't say on there, this is gas tuna now. You know? But at least you can tell where it's from and do the figuring.
Right, and that's taken a long time, and sometimes you even have to know where the fish come from originally, because it may say wild caught from the USA, but it may be caught in Micronesia, shipped to San Francisco, repackaged, sent here. So
that's why one of the things that I talked about earlier on the program was this vote of confidence that I continue to give and everybody that I know gives to the United Fish Agency auction, to the longline fleet, because their fish is, and it's off the subject you and I are going to talk about today, but if you go down there and see, like we all go down there, you see this UPC number, this barcode on the fish, you think, what's that? It tells a lot.
Yeah, you can basically track your fish from a boat to the store, almost just about.
Yeah, and what that does is it enables everybody to very quickly react to a concern or a condition.
Yeah, and if something happens, you know exactly where it came from, you know which wholesaler, and then maybe even which boat.
Yeah, and they say that there's some things on the mainland now and in other parts of the world where you can tell where the flank steak came from. We've sort of adopted that, and you got to give credit to the auction, because in the very beginning, that must have been a very costly and cumbersome thing to install.
Oh, it's probably more than they needed to do, but I think it's kudos to them for actually getting something on board so that they can produce quality for their customers.
Yeah, and we can talk about that till the cows come home. And that is the lead into what we're going to talk about today. A lot of what you think you know, you don't know. And a lot of what we do on this program, particularly with the council and them being one of the sponsors of our show, is call attention to what they do. And I am blown away at the amount of research, at the amount of dissemination of information takes place when you and I are sleeping or working or wondering about our next piece of fish. Today, I'm so stoked to be able to talk to Josh about something called monographs. And this is not phonograph. This is not a tape player. It's a monograph. Okay, so before we get serious, what's a monograph?
Well, monographs for us is basically our internal report series, a publication that the council puts out that details the work that the council's been doing.
And the intended readers, obviously, are stakeholders and a lot of other people. But now I know that inquiring minds want to know that you got kids in school that want to know about this stuff.
There is. And we try to write it so that it's not so heavily research-oriented, like a scientific paper. It's more of just telling the story, basically. Yeah.
But obviously there's rhyme and reason. So today we're going to talk about a couple of different specific projects. When you do these reports, the use is not just to show the massive amount of work going on in your office, but for what?
Well, part of it, at least these three new ones that we're going to talk about today, a lot of it is to brag about what's been going on in the region. Mm-hmm. We don't get a lot of credit,
we get a lot of criticism,
right? Right. You can Google the council's name and you come up with a lot of stories.
Oh my goodness, who are these guys?
Yeah. Right. But there's a lot of things that the council has been first in the nation in doing, and it's time that the council speaks up for itself, because if you're not going to brag about yourself, nobody's going
to
brag for
you. Amen. And that's why it's sort of interesting to me that these reports are not so much a horn blow, but a sort of a discovery that you guys make. So, in other words, maybe we should back up. What interests people like yourself? I mean, when you first got into it, did you think that you were going to have this hat on your head saying fisheries analyst?
When I started, I started as an intern, so I didn't even know what fisheries were. But thanks to Dr. Craig Severance at UH Hilo and some of the other folks I've met, I've learned a lot. And the monographs are a way to download all of that information into one source, so that we have all this institutional knowledge built up over the years. Mm-hmm. It's a place for it to be housed and shared with everyone else.
Okay, and the reason why we want to highlight this is, when I say bragging about the council, is because in the very beginning, the council wanted to make sure that people that were going to be stakeholders or information providers or partners consider this a ground-up organization. There's still a lot of concern about there, but I want to say that these monographs that we're going to talk about today, Josh, and you can comment to this, is that they're only as good as the information that you can gather. And the council is not like overabundantly overstaffed with plenty of people that go out and get information. You rely on stakeholders. You rely on fisheries. And I need you to explain how much more valuable the information that you're able to produce today in these reports is than the anecdotal stuff that you weren't getting from before.
And that's the key. It's anecdotal. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of stuff we have is anecdotal. Mm-hmm. It's not written down. So when we're talking about using best available science or something, it's not there for us to actually pick up and use and say, hey, here's the best available science. Yeah. Here's what we know, because we only know what we've been talking to each other about. So this gives a place for us to actually write down all this information, a citable source in the literature that can be used by everyone.
Okay, and these three things that we're going to go over today, gang, and with Josh Jamello is important. And here's a thing, and I want to go back. There's this guy that I met when I was doing my Portraits of Paradise TV show years ago named Ski Kwiatkowski. He was in charge of security at one of the hotels at Anai Ho'omalu Bay on the Big Island. And he was the one that really discovered and kapu'd these great petroglyphs that are carved all over the Anai Ho'omalu area on the Big Island. And he told me, I said, what is this one over here? He said, that's a classroom for how to catch a coolie.
Wow.
And it was in petroglyphs, in stone. And that's what you're talking about, the anecdotal information. Some of them say, how did you learn that? I learned it at Anai Ho'omalu. In other words, here is, once you get it, you can understand how graphically these petroglyphs became. Isn't that the same thing when you're talking about some kupuna at Hanalei Bay about when the akuli come in there?
Right. So really, you're really getting all that information that's out there in the ether and putting it somewhere so that it doesn't get lost in the
future. Yeah, what I like about it, you folks, and we're going to get into this as we get into these three reports, is that I want to know the reaction of some of the people at Kokua for this when they finally get in their hand and say, oh, now I get it. I didn't know exactly what you were trying to do. Now I kind of get it.
Yeah, I think the initial reaction was, wow, you did all of this?
Yeah, all of this from just us.
You know? Right.
Okay, let's talk about these and how they're broken out into three separate areas, because they say Pacific Island Fishery Monographs. What first of all, is there any particular order in which they should be looked at?
We have, it's all serialized, so we have 6, 7, 8. Mm-hmm. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 already, but 6, 7, 8 are the three newest monographs. In the past, we've done one on the history of the black coral fishery, and that one was done by the late Dr. Rick Grigg.
Right.
We've done one on...
It's hard for me to hear you say that, because he was such a good pal, right?
Right. Yeah. And a mentor in the black coral field. We've done one on the international fishery management with the WCPFC. We've done one on our turtle program. We have one that's finishing up on the fleets of the Western Pacific, a profile of the different fleets. So I think
the first one I want to get into, it says number 6, is because one of the first things I saw in it was them offloading tuna and in a way that I've never seen it, and that is with this big high crane, and there's this like a chain of tuna, and there are these huge 100-plus-pound fish hanging in a chain 10 or 15 long. I mean, it's amazing what was done, particularly in the far reaches of the control of the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, what some of these people have to do to harvest.
Right. So this monograph, number 6, details the work that the council has done to help develop fisheries in the different island areas of the Western Pacific, particularly American Samoa, Guam, and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands.
Okay, let me ask you this, because I want to know specifically about it, but a few programs ago, we were talking about how the shared quota is, and the income that these areas get from the longline fleet in Hawaii go to not their longline fleet, but go to develop other areas of the fishery that are of more need to them.
Right, so a lot of these projects come from that funding.
Mm-hmm.
They have a marine conservation plan that lists out projects that have different things that the government would like to see done to help promote fisheries, and a lot of their projects have been funded through that process and detailed in this monograph.
Okay, so this one, you said American Samoa, Guam, and the Northern Marianas.
Right.
And what was its target? On the cover, by the way, this one is a large service ship, Lady Carolina, and a Miss Saipan, which is a typical regular size longliner.
Right. Yeah. So the picture shows a couple of longline boats out in Saipan that they tried to start up a longline fishery, but through different machinations and different owners, it was a little tough. But the council worked on a bunch of different projects. They're still working on projects to help improve their facilities and infrastructure to allow for, for longlining.
Why I think that's key is because we can interject again here, not just about the safety of our fish that go through the United Fish Agency auction, but the fact that we have such a highly regulated longline fleet in Hawaii that some of the practices that have learned and been skilled here end up going on into those parts of the world where they would not have had anywhere near the sophistication that our fleet has.
Right, because they'll look to Asia because of Asia is so much closer, and they'll try and mimic what Asia is doing out there. But if we can start molding that fishery into something that's similar to what's going on in American Samoa and Hawaii, then we'd have a more robust fishery that can handle these different regulations that come out.
The thing that I like is that it's you think that these are three little beautiful coffee table picture magazines that are just warm and fuzzy, but they actually show the nuts and bolts of it. In other words, there's a lot of people that don't understand outside of the fact that you have a skilled captain and a crew out there catching fish, there's a whole lot of stuff going on in the factories, on the docks, and I mean, a boat ramp, for instance. How do you go catch fish if you don't have a boat ramp?
Right.
You know.
Right. If you're or if your boat ramp's on one side of the island, you
and
have
the
to drive.
The fish are on the other side. Right.
Right. And but the fish are on your side. You have to drive all the way to the other side of the island, drop your boat, and drive all the way back to the other side. Mm-hmm. So some of these villages, like in American Samoa, we've helped to build boat
ramps. Build a new ramp.
Yeah, right, yeah. Just right there in their village. They can just drop their boat and go out and catch fish and bring it back for the village.
You know, a lot of us that are on the main Hawaiian islands don't relate to some of the places that we're talking about, because some of the islands that we're talking about in this report and others are very small. You can drive around it in 10 minutes.
Right.
But it's still, if you're remotely there on one of those islands, just the difference in fuel availability and going from where to where. Like, you got to assume that where the boat ramp is where the fuel is.
Right. So somewhere like Manua, the Manua Islands are the outer islands of American Samoa. Mm-hmm. We've helped to provide both ice and fuel to these villages, because there's no place to fuel up for your boat. Yeah. And if you can't fuel up your boat, you can't go fishing, you can't feed the community. Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be, I guess, back in the day when people were not, and fish were plentiful, that you could just jump in the water right out in front of your place, catch fish, and everybody's happy. And then this thing called ice came along, right?
Right.
I mean, when I was a kid and going to Tahiti, you would see on the side of the road like a teepee, I mean, three sticks and some fish hanging from it. People would drive by and buy the fish. That's like it was my first experience at what a real drive-through window was, because you're just driving up. No ice, no nothing, no bags, no nothing, you know. You see kids with loaves of bread under their arm running down the street. Well, it's not acceptable anymore, right? So these people are, what are they modernizing? Because they need to, or because they want to, or both?
Well, part of it, like you said, the outbreaks of salmonella and hepatitis and all that kind of stuff. It's, I don't know if it's more frequent now, or it's just that we're more aware of it now, instead of, you know, our stomach is sore, it might be salmonella poisoning. Yeah. So,
well, you know, one thing that it speaks to that, and that came up on my regular show the other day, and the reason was all of the above, because there's more of us, so that when somebody's infected with something, they're probably in more contact with more people than they used to be. You know, if you were sick on a farm back in the day, there was nobody for miles. But now, you know, your neighbor's out in front and you shake hands every day. Now, I just shook hands with a guy that just had salmonella, shook hands with you. I got lucky you got salmonella now.
Right. Well, and there's more people, there's more impact and effluent going out into the ocean or just in the area as well.
When you go, first of all, a lot of the work on these monographs, and let's talk about this first one, number 6, is actually in the field there at their locale. How difficult is it when you plan a trip and the expenses and everything else to be able to get, you know, the mission accomplished each time you go on one of these trips?
Well, luckily for us, we have our island coordinators there. that were on the show a couple weeks back. They've been following up. We also have our council members. And a lot of the work is actually done by contractors to go out and do a study. We go when we can, or we take advantage of other meetings we have there to have meetings like a long lines dock feasibility meeting or workshop with the fishermen.
Well, let's take maybe a case in point where you've done some work and determined that this village needs a boat ramp. That I would imagine that the report would lend to the credibility of the need, so that then somebody could say, okay, well, we'll pay the money. Because in the bottom line is, you can say, well, they built a boat ramp, and I know in some of those places they can do miracles with, you know, a little stick and a shovel, but it's still, a lot of these things take funding.
It takes a lot of funding because they're remote areas and just the cost of supplies is just outrageous.
Yeah, how do you get a bag of cement to a place that's never seen one, right?
Right. Yeah. And really, I think we owe a lot of thanks to the partners we work with down there, the local agencies, the wildlife and resource agencies down there who work with their partner agencies that are in their environmental compliance or construction.
Yeah, I got to tell you, and Josh can give you an example of this way more than I can, but we take so for granted. When I leave here today, I got to go by Home Depot and I got to grab some stuff. I go in there, it's like our friends in the neighbor in these remote locations, they would die to be able to have a store like that. Aren't you amazed at some of the things these people can do? And out of thin air, they pull a rabbit out of the hat and they make something happen?
Oh, it's some of these islands, it's, you know, just to have a computer that that works in some villages. I mean, for the most part, you have good internet everywhere, but but some places, just to get your computer repaired, it's amazing that someone can do it.
I know people here flip out if they have to bring it down to a place for one day and get the thing scrubbed and cleaned. But when you say, well, you know, we'll get this back to you in a month or so, you know.
Right.
What am I going to do for the next 29 days? Okay, so let's get back to this one, though. This specific first one, number 6, what was its intent? What did it entail?
So a lot of projects that went on, you hear about it, but you don't really know how it started. Or you might drive by the new boat ramp and go, hey, there's a new boat ramp. Where did that come from? Then you see the sign, but what's the story behind it? So a lot of that is the story behind it. For instance, in Guam, there's the fishing platform out in Agana Basin. The people wanted a platform that they could fish from because it's just rocks. So like out at out in Kaka'ako,
okay,
there's just those rock walls, the berms that keep,
and that's it,
right? And that's it. And a lot of the populace is older or handicapped, wheelchairs or something. So fishing from that site is not good for them.
Hey, listen, I don't care if you're in great shape; it's tough,
right?
It's slippery, it's wet, you fall down, it's Ike's. You know,
so that's probably one of the bigger stories because it's taken a long time going through Army Corps of Engineers, getting permits and doing the environmental assessment. But now they have this platform that extends over those rocks, so people can go out and stand on a flat surface. You know, if they're in a wheelchair, they can throw their rod from over the rail.
I got to tell you, I was laughing the other day because of the sheer comedy of what I saw. I was out at a state boat ramp. I won't say which one because I don't want to get them angry. But there's a pier, okay, and there's vehicular availability. You can get right up to it, and there's big signs, no fishing, you know, and there's a guy's bait bucket was hanging from it. He had 4 or 5 poles, and the guy was. Why was he there? Because he could. He could back right up and do that. But they don't have some of these areas. They don't have that privilege. So, in other words, that simple thing like building that platform was like a new day for somebody.
Yeah, especially when it's a traditional place to go fishing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, these old timers haven't been able to fish there because of handicap or some other ailment.
I got to tell you a funny little side story, too, because when you say that, when you get used to it, I've been the finish line announcer at the Molokai Hoi for many, many years. And one of the first things I do every time I get out to that pier is look over the side to see if the stickfish are there.
Yeah.
Because I don't know where they come from, but there's a million of them. And it means it's a good year if they're there because the environment's still cool for them. Isn't it the same thing that these folks know, even if they fished a place when they were a little 3-year-old kid, they remember that for their whole life. And if they can't get out to that rock, their quality of life suffers.
I guess it's like surfing. You know, you learn to surf at maybe Queens or canoes and you may go everywhere else, but you still know that wave. That wave is still
that's
there.
That's the one, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know how it breaks. You can paddle out to the exact spot in between the church and the lifeguard stand and still find your spot.
Now that you've been doing this for as long as you have, I'd be interested in your opinion, or you can share with the audience, what happens when you go back to a place that has had something happen as a result of one of these studies. You know, in other words, you come in and you do your study, and then you present, these are the things that maybe should be looked at in this area. How many of them actually come true? And what is it like for those people at the other end that are the benefits of the program or of the report?
I think we've seen some positive changes. A lot of times what happens is that we get there so late in the game that it's, that what happens is you're going to have to increase regulations just to get it back to that baseline.
Some semblance of normal.
Right. Right. Yeah. Back to what people remember. And there's so many other factors that's really what I found out, is that there's so many other factors involved besides fishing that affect the environment that it's really hard to pinpoint any one reason to.
Yeah, but let me. Here's a real pressing one, and I know that some of the work on these programs we're going to talk about as we continue are important. But right now, the big buzz is on global warming and rising sea temperatures and everything else. And I don't care what somebody thinks of that, whether it's all bogus or whether it's all part of the big plan. There are changes that happen all the time, right? And isn't the pressure on some of these places that you've been for these to be concerned about what are we going to do when this happens, or how are we going to prevent this from happening? Pretty hard to prevent it if it's coming.
It is. Yeah. Because it's going to happen. It doesn't matter what you do, it's going to happen.
Yeah,
So really, it's about being resilient and being able to forecast what's going to happen so that you watch what you do now so that in the future it's not as impacted as it may be.
But when you started, wasn't that just maybe sometimes talked about in that part of the world? And now it's like front burner because there's so many, quote, groups that want to save the world.
And that's been the sort of tough part because these are islands. Islands are resilient just by nature because they live through hurricanes all the time.
Yeah.
So they know, like, so in Guam, they've built their houses out of cement instead of having wooden houses.
Yeah, because they
houses.
Know it's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, so and they have rebar sticking out because they know that once the typhoon's gone, there's your place to be rebuilding.
We had a really good example of that here locally not too long ago with the discovery of some petroglyphs on Oahu that had been uncovered that were covered up for who knows decades.
Yeah,
you know, and all of a sudden, Mama Nature comes in, the beach changes, and everybody's like, whoa, what is this? We got to protect it. Now there's a whole group saying, save the Aina because it's there, right?
Well, you know not to build your house so close to the beach because it's going to erode. And then you go to some place, you go some of these beaches that the sand leaves in the winter and comes back in the summer.
That. Hey, look at the North Shore. Look at how every year the surfers go out there and where's the beach? The one that really cracked me up, though, was a guy on Kauai that had a duplex on the highway, and across the street from the highway was the beach. Now he has beachfront. And the road goes behind them because it just came in and changed that much. But I think that maybe isolating in time, when you guys are, you know, have to justify what this report is being done for, its end user is got to be the thing. That's why I want people to know a little bit about this. If they go to wpcouncil.org, can they find out about these monographs and can they acquire them?
They can download them from our website.
Wonderful.
And if you want a hard copy, you can always call and request a hard copy.
And that's wpcouncil.org. And I think that if you just did that, first of all, kids, any kid that has any interest in the ocean would be well served to have a little adult supervision saying, here is a resource for you because you guys are putting so much energy into that. It must be nice to know that the readership or the viewership is going up the way the social media is working.
Oh, I sure hope that people are taking advantage of looking at all this information available. Yeah. It's just a huge expanse of information across the internet that we don't have to look up things in the Encyclopedia Britannica anymore. It's all there at your fingertips.
Okay, so we talked about this report number 6. One of its features was the Guam fishing platform. We talked about boat ramps in American Samoa. And this is fisheries development. That's number 6. Now, we also have 2 more, number 7 and 8. What is number 7?
Number 7 details our work with the communities, with the particularly the indigenous communities of the Western Pacific. There's different programs that the council has sponsored over the years, including the Community Demonstration Project Program, which provided grants to communities to help develop fisheries and other interested projects and ideas related to fisheries and fishing management.
You know, I'm so jealous in some respects because I get to do the show every week with Josh and with others from the council. And that when a report like this comes up and I see the people that we deal with all the time actually in these places, it reminds us not just how big the world is, but also the great responsibility that all you guys share going and doing your thing in all these places. So in this one, in this particular one, getting into the fishing communities, that I know is Charlie Ka'ai's milieu. He is really he knows what his job is with regards to creating that bridge between the indigenous people and reality or in government or population,
right? So a lot of the work that Charlie has done includes working with different groups, fish ponds, the projects working on limu restoration, people in the CNMI looking to do a fish market to have a place.
Yeah, and by the way, that CNMI is a very, very interesting part of the council's tentacles. And we met, some of you met the CMNI guys last time during the meeting, the council meeting. They seem to me so appreciative, not just to be participants, but to be beneficiaries of all of the stuff that's coming their way.
Right, and these are projects that would not go on because they just don't have the funding to do so. So any little bit helps all the time.
Well, you know, what dawns on me is we call it here, I forget which local politician came up with, nice to have, must to have, or whatever. To me, it doesn't seem like these guys have the option of not having these things. They really need them.
Right. And they need them, but they get by without them.
Yeah.
But it would
they're resourceful.
Right. So a lot of these different things that we've done over the years went from these project based to more of this wider idea of traditional management, community based management, lunar calendars.
Mm-hmm.
We've also done work with the First Stewards, the Native Americans, and on climate change, because the First Peoples nations were the original folks that have seen the climate change happening, and they've adapted and adjusted
over the years. They actually pass it down from generation. It's unbelievable how cyclical we see this is. I mean, there was global warming when there was no cars creating carbon monoxide. I mean, this is not something that is new to the planet. But what I think is more important, and I learned this my first trip to Pohnpei, this guy said, we go fishing. So he jumped in this little boat, and the fish was right outside the reef. But when they, I said, well, where's the gear? Oh yeah, they had a burlap bag, and in their burlap bag were four Clorox bottles with line wound around them and a lure. And that was it. No drag, no reels, no poles, and you're catching tuna that could pull you into the water. I think that sometimes these people are just, they get this big eye-opening when you guys get there and say, oh, I brought this thing, it's called a reel, or this is called a lure, do you guys want some?
Yeah, and sometimes it's, you get met with resistance because even in Saipan now, the divers are still using those wooden goggles that my grandfather had back in the day.
I used to get migraine headaches from those things when I was a kid. Yeah,
and plywood fins. I mean, with just a pole and a piece of rubber, and that's all you have.
You know what though? That really differentiates between the guy that's got the technology and the guy that's got the knowledge. I mean, you can have the technology. You can catch a fish with your electric downrigger, and you don't even have to get your hands wet. But if you can jump down there with your bamboo goggles and your plywood fins and go get that same fish, you're pretty good.
Well, that's like I tell my kids all the time. It's a bad craftsman that blames his tools.
Yeah, really, that's really true. Buy a bigger ladder. Okay, well, anyway, but this particular one, it is that the one in which it is sometimes difficult to get the villagers or the people that are going to be the beneficiaries to realize how valuable it's going to be?
At times it is.
Yeah.
I think with this monograph, it really shows that we are working a lot in the community. You know, a lot of people say, we're working with the community. Yeah, we're doing stuff in the community. If you read this monograph, we have done a lot with the community. I mean, I helped Charlie with the draft and editing, and we really started just adding. And we had something so big that we had to cut back.
What I think is interesting is that's what I wanted to ask you, what goes into the editing process. In other words, you have a lot of information. You produce this, you know, this handy report, but it does have to cut to the chase. So, I mean, you can't make it volumes because people's attention span are like a fire hydrant. You really need to get somebody in. We're in a fast day, right? We got to say, what is this? Okay, where's the scoops?
And I think that's the beauty of these monographs is that it's not a book where you have to read the whole thing to get the story. You can go in and look at the table of contents, and you want to know about something, take look at this, and it's maybe a page and a half.
And what I like about this, friends, is that it's not, in my opinion, and I think my opinion for you listeners is valuable in this case, because as you know, POP is a sponsor of the show and the council is a sponsor of the show, but I don't have any reins on me. In other words, it's still what I think is important, and that means that I kind of have anonymity, and I've seen this, the success of this, like you couldn't believe, like Josh is saying, that, you know, we have a responsibility to everybody in this fishery, and that's why this is another one that when they say that, I don't want modern this, and I don't want you to allow this modern that to come in, but I like that one scoop net. Maybe we can use that. In other words, let's walk before we run in some of these areas.
Yeah, and it's all about learning about the traditional ecological knowledge and seeing how we can adapt our modern management to what we've always known.
Yeah, here's one thing that I want to get into while we have still a little bit of time, and this is the third and final report. This is number 8. And most of us, when we talk on this show, we talk about pelagic surface-running game fish. We talk about the meat. We talk about the big eye. We talk about ahi, mai-mai, ono, marlin. We talk about opa. This other one is really interesting, that a lot of the fishery in this big ocean of ours are for little things that fit in a frying pan. There's a big difference. So let's talk a little bit about this. The things like ta'api and to'au and manini and things that some people, a lot of this audience, has never eaten.
So monograph number 8 is really looking at our coral reef ecosystem program. Mm-hmm. It started back in the late 80s, early 90s, and the council got into looking at what would it take to create a fishery management plan for coral reef ecosystems. Through that process, the council actually became the first council in the country to develop an ecosystem management plan.
Yeah, and is that because of all of the councils in the country, we are the ones that most use that part of the fishery?
And it's mainly because I think the council has always been at the forefront of what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
They started with ecosystem-based management workshops, but we started trying to incorporate that into our management. So the coral reef, we went from species-based to the coral reef ecosystem because, mm-hmm. you know, you can take a manini, but what does that mean to the habitat and the rest of the fish that use the habitat? And now we're seeing things like the state of Hawaii's ban on herbivores in Maui.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that if you take the herbivores, the seaweed just grows out of control because there's nothing to eat that seaweed.
Yep.
And then it takes over the reef, kills off the reef. So that kind of concept is what we wanted to bring into the coral reef ecosystem.
And what I found really interesting about that was that anecdotally, you gather this information, but what statistically worked back in the day that got thrown out by a lot of modernization, we're going back to. I think it's a wonderful return to the way that we were developing management areas, management in specific areas rather than a broad sweep. Because my question is really, when national fisheries make rules and judgments on us, they don't know the value of this resource or the need for this resource as we do, I don't think.
Well, and they don't know what they do and how it affects the rest of the ecosystem.
Yep.
I mean, you can say don't catch fish, but if you don't catch the fish, you're going to have all these other species that depend on the reef start disappearing. Or you might, you may have increased predators, and then you don't want all those predators there because that's a swim spot for kids or a surf spot.
And look what's happening in the monument. And, and some of these apex predators, ulua and some of the other things, they're chomping up a lot of vegetables.
Right. That's one of the problems. Yeah. But I think the good thing about this monograph is that it also talks about all the different projects we've done under the funding we've got from the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program.
I'm blown away, by the way, folks. You got to get this report. You got to go look at it.
It's set up by different topics, research and historical research on coral reefs. And then we look at information from coral reefs and coral reef species, and then research on the ecosystem. And a lot of it, there's summaries in here that talk about the project. And then you can go to our website, wpcouncil.org, and download the full reports.
Yeah, and that's what I want you to do. It's wpcouncil.org. Now, there are 7 of these, and you can get a hard copy if you want, but what I really want to do is I want you to expose your kids, and especially your college-bound kids and even yourself if you're in that milieu, because I know that we have a lot of young people that are skeptical about any organization. They're skeptical about government, and they're just skeptics, period. This is a way to get your eyes open, because I really do believe, Josh, that a way I want people to end our discussion today to understand that if they could come down and meet all you guys, there's no agenda. Everybody is driven to the fishery for a different reason. And it's not that you want to prevent people from catching fish. You actually want people to catch the right fish they need when it's right for everybody.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
It kind of is that simple in many respects, isn't it?
Right. And you know, do your homework. Go check out what's out there and talk to people. And don't just make assumptions. Come out and talk to us.
Yep. And by the way, every now and again, we talked about Manini, we talked about Ta'api. Maybe some parts of the year you better say, okay, I'll eat Ta'api at this time of the year because Uncle told me that that's when the Manini are growing, we should leave them alone.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. So if you want to know more about what these monographs are all about, you go to WPCouncil.org. WPCouncil.org, we're heading towards the holidays. Next week, we're going to spend some time, serious time, on what happens at the fish auction and what's safe to eat and how the council is involved in that and how the longline fleet and the fish processors and the fish retailers and everything. But in the meantime, if you want to know more about what Josh and his guys do and gals, go to WPCouncil.org. And our special thanks to everybody for being a part of the show today. We'll see you next time. In the meantime, if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line. The best way to do it is my regular show address, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Have a great weekend. See you next time.